Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Yesterday, at a hearing of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee in Washington, Dr. Anthony Fauci and Senator Rand Paul accused each other of lying in a heated exchange. Today on Midday, an interview I recorded with Dr. Fauci last week, in which we talked about responding to people who refuse to be vaccinated and the role of government as private entities begin implementing vaccine mandates.
I do know that the federal government will not be mandating passports, but they could get involved in making sure it's done correctly.
We'll also get perspective on the uptick in COVID cases around the world from Dr. Gigi Granvall, a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russick reviews And Then There Were None, a new production at Cockpit in Court. First, the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very, very grateful to you for being along for the ride. For 10 days in a row now, the state of Maryland is reporting more than 100 new cases of COVID-19. As my colleague Nathan Sterner has shared with you this morning, the state health department announced that Maryland has confirmed 244 new cases of the coronavirus since yesterday. The last time the state recorded more than 200 new cases in a single day was back on May 30th. Maryland's average testing positivity rate has ticked up to 1.65%, about where it was at the end of May. Maryland's positivity rate is still low compared to many other states, but it continues to creep upwards. State health officials say the highly contagious Delta variant of the virus accounts for most of the new cases. Nationwide, it accounts for 85% of all new cases. In June here in Maryland, all of the deaths from COVID-19, 95% of the new cases, and 93% of hospitalizations due to the virus were for patients who had not been vaccinated. Today on Midday, we begin with an interview I conducted last week with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases and President Joe Biden's senior medical advisor. The video of the interview has been posted on our website, but this is the first opportunity we've had to include it on a Midday broadcast. We spoke about a week ago Monday. When we spoke that morning, Dr. Fauci thought that he and other government medical officials would be meeting with executives from Pfizer the following day to discuss the need for those who have received two vaccine doses to get a third booster shot. That meeting actually took place online a few hours after Dr. Fauci and I spoke. I also mentioned Dr. Fauci's past disagreements with Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. And just yesterday, Fauci and Paul had a particularly heated exchange at a hearing, which I'll talk about later in the program with Dr. Gigi Granvall of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Here's my conversation with Dr. Fauci.
Dr. Fauci, welcome to WYPR in Baltimore. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you've talked recently about the importance or the helpfulness of local mandates. Universities, cruise lines, medical institutions. I wonder, are there circumstances that would cause you to recommend to the president that he call for a national mandate for vaccination?
You know, Tom, the answer to that would have to be no. And the reason I say that is that the amount of pushback that we would almost certainly get if you get a national mandate, I think could turn out to be counterproductive and people pushing back purely on the basis of not wanting something mandated centrally. But what, as I have said multiple times and most recently, I do think it would be a reasonable thing to consider to have mandates at the local level, to have universities, colleges, places of business, cruise ships, travel, and things like that. That will likely be more easy to implement once the vaccine gets fully approved by the FDA. You know, there's this very interesting feeling that because it's an emergency use authorization, that there is some concern about it. So people are hesitant to do that. And then there's the legal issue. Can you mandate something that isn't fully approved? We're in an unusual situation where even though we're still under an emergency use authorization, the amount of data to absolutely prove beyond a doubt that this is a highly effective vaccine and very, very safe is extraordinary, Tom. I mean, the amount of data we have for an EUA is more data than we usually have for full approval of many other interventions. So it's really equivalent to a full approval, but technically speaking, it is not yet there.
And it does seem to lay people like myself that it's taking a good bit of time for that emergency use authorization to evolve into actual authorization. Can you give us a sense of the timeline when you expect these vaccines to be approved?
Well, a couple of things, Tom. You don't want to get ahead of the FDA. That's never helpful to make a prediction. So because it's their job to do it. But this is not out of the ordinary. This is the usual amount of time it takes. The reason it seems, understandably, that it is a bit longer than you would want is that the data showing the degree of effectiveness in the real world is so overwhelmingly convincing that it's a natural question for people to ask, like, what's the problem here? Why not? And there's no problem. This is just the way the FDA dots all the I's and crosses all the T's to make sure that when they give their final imprimatur on something, it's really bulletproof.
And do you have an expectation? As you mentioned, there are people who, for whatever reason, may think that the initial rollout of this vaccine was done in a hurried, fast-track fashion, and that once it is approved officially, that'll be the hump that they need to get over to diminish their hesitancy. Do you have any data, any polling, any understanding that once that happens, we will see a surge in people willing to get vaccinated?
Yeah, the general polling is that there will be a fraction of people, and it varies, 10, 15, 20% or so, who really are waiting to get that full approval before they go ahead. And they will go ahead once you get it. But probably more influenced by that is the hesitancy now of people mandating vaccines at the local level until they do get full approval. So what you're going to very likely see is a combination of people just coming over and saying, okay, now it's good, I'm going to get vaccinated. And there's going to be a lot of universities, colleges, businesses that are going to say, all right, now once it's fully approved, if you want to work in our establishment, you got to show that you're vaccinated. And I think there's going to be a lot more of that.
And for those folks whose decision not to get vaccinated is premised in politics, or when they have an argument with people who support vaccination, they frame it in terms of personal liberty. You and Senator Paul have had any number of public discussions about that. When that argument is happening, it seems that the two sides aren't even talking in the same space. As a public health official, you're responsible for all of America. You've talked about the danger of two Americas. But I wonder, at what point, what is the obligation to those people who simply refuse to get vaccinated because they think it is perfectly legitimate to make a personal decision not to get vaccinated? At what point does one say, well, for those of us who are vaccinated, we're going to continue to have policies and have information that will help you? Is there a particular obligation we have to those people who just won't take the vaccine?
I think as health officials, we do have an obligation to try and get them to understand why it's important. You certainly don't want to be finger pointing or pushing hard, because that will only have them double down on their libertarian approach that you can't tell me what to do, I'm going to do what I want to do. It's just to try and get, and this is what we are trying to do, what we're referring to as trusted messengers, so that they don't perceive it's the federal government telling them they need to do this, but they look upon it as perhaps their clergy that they trust, their family physician, local community leaders, sports figures, and people who are admired by the community, to get them to engage in a dialogue about why it's important for individuals, for their own health and safety, for the health and safety of their family, and also for what we call communal responsibility. Because you really want to crush this outbreak in this country. And the frustrating and sometimes or somewhat ironic aspect of it all is that in this country, we have enough vaccine to vaccinate everybody. And yet there are people and countries throughout the world who would do anything to get vaccinated because they're suffering terribly through the spread of this particularly troublesome variant, the Delta variant. And we have everything we need in this country, and we still have a certain percentage of people who don't want to get vaccinated. So that's one of the frustrating things.
Can we crush COVID-19, SARS-CoV-2, with a 75% vaccination rate? We're still just under 70% at this juncture. I mean, what are the metrics that you're going to be looking to decide that this, in fact, is over, that we have put COVID-19 in the rearview mirror?
That's a good question, Tom, and we don't really have a good number for you, because this is a bad acting virus. It continues to evolve with different variants. We've already seen that. You know, if you look at the last year and a half, how it's gone, you know, from one variant to another, to now we have the Delta variant, which is becoming dominant throughout many countries throughout the world. The reason I bring that up is that we don't know what percentage of unvaccinated people in the country would allow the virus to continue to circulate enough to be able to evolve, mutate even more, so that it then negatively impacts even the vaccinated people. So that's what I call and refer to as your communal responsibility. Because there's a tenet in virology, Tom, that's very true, is that viruses don't mutate unless you allow them to replicate. And as long as they're out there replicating, they have the capability of mutating. And if you give them enough leeway, they're going to mutate. Most mutations don't mean anything. You know, they just functionally are not relevant. But every once in a while, you get a constellation of mutations that actually alter the function of the virus, namely making it more transmissible, allowing it to evade monoclonal antibodies as well as antibodies that are induced by vaccines. So when I use the word crush the virus, I mean get so many people vaccinated in this country that the virus has no place to go. So it doesn't have free rein to bounce back and forth among people, that it's essentially boxed in. That's what I mean. I don't mean eradicating it. I don't think we're going to eradicate this virus, at least not for a very, very long time. But at least to get the level of dynamics of the virus so low that the chances of there being the evolution of more variants would be extremely low.
Pfizer BioNTech has recently suggested that a booster is going to be necessary. You and the CDC have talked about how that's not the case right now. Is the Pfizer announcement based on data that they have collected, research that they have done, or are they using research and data from Israel and other places? And then I understand there are meetings planned for them to share what they know with you all. What's the timeline for that? When will this get sorted out?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and we will get the answer to that. I was on the phone when they made the announcement, because I was concerned that, you know, in some respects, they took everybody by surprise. Yeah. by making that announcement, asking the chief medical officer what was going on. And we've arranged for the Pfizer people to brief us tomorrow, Tuesday. So we will have a briefing from them. Then we'll be discussing it at the level of the department. we want to get this sorted out. From what I can gather, Tom, it's a combination of data from Israel, as well as follow-up studies from their original phase three trial. So when the CDC and the FDA said, we don't feel that we need a booster right now, I think you need to underline the right now aspect of it, because you want to leave open the possibility that when we see their data, as well as examine the data that the CDC has been collecting, there very well may be a decision that we'll need a booster. But the CDC says it again and again. Right now, we don't think that's the case, but we are very, very actively evaluating all the scientific data as it comes in, and that might change, actually.
I know we need to let you go very shortly, but one more question about local mandates, mandates from businesses, universities, et cetera. Does that mandate protocol automatically assume that there is some universally accepted authentication protocol as well? And is there a role for the government in regulating or developing ways for people to prove that they've been vaccinated?
Right. What we're calling vaccine passports. And as we said, the federal government is not going to require a vaccine passport, but the federal government could get involved in making sure that when outside entities have vaccine passports, if you want to call it that, there's a degree of uniformity to it, of reproducibility to it, you know, so that it isn't just things going around each and every which way. So there could be some standards that are created. Again, I don't want to get ahead of it. It's possible. I'm not making that as a decision because I don't make those decisions. But I do know that the federal government will not be mandating passports, but they could get involved in making sure it's done correctly for whoever does it.
How are you doing personally, you and your family? You've been subjected to all sorts of abuse and threats. Have they abated at all as this crisis has continued? How are you all doing?
I'm doing fine, Tom. I'm used to it. I focus on my job, you know, and my job is to develop the vaccines, make sure they get implemented, to develop drugs, to stay with the science and the public health. The other stuff is not pleasant, of course. I mean, to get attacked by very fringe elements, and you know what they are. I don't want to mention them, but I'm doing fine. My family's, you know, they're fine too. I mean, they don't like the idea that I'm getting attacked. They get attacked too, which really, if anything gets me aggravated, Tom, it's, you know, getting my family involved in this, my wife and my children, which is really ridiculous. It shows you the low life that are doing that. I mean, it's just, you know, enough said.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much for your service and for your time today. Very much appreciated.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you as always.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, we spoke last week. Quick break now, and when we return, more on the fight against COVID-19 with Dr. Gigi Granvall of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.